It's October 17th, 1956, in the Aberdare Mountains of Kenya. A young British soldier claws his way through dense forest, sweat dripping from his brow. Every step is hard, slow work. The trees play tricks on the eyes. Every flicker of movement in the shadows looks like the enemy, but the soldier is right to be on guard. Kenya has been a British colony for almost seven decades, but 4 years ago, an insurgent group known as the Mau Mau rose in rebellion, demanding independence. The British response has been brutal, crushing the uprising and driving the rebels into Kenya's central highlands. This young soldier has been sent here to hunt down the final few members of the resistance, but earlier today, his detachment was caught in a chaotic ambush. In the confusion, he lost his weapon and was cut off from his comrades. Now he's all alone, following muddy tracks deeper into the forest, unable to tell whether they belong to friend or foe. Suddenly, he hears movement ahead and drops to the ground. Through a screen of thick green bamboo, he watches a figure emerge from the forest, a man wearing a leopard skin jacket. The soldier's pulse spikes as he recognizes him. It's the rebel leader himself, Dedan Kimathi. The soldier watches as Kimathi climbs up a steep, muddy slope. It could be the soldier's chance to capture Kenya's most infamous outlaw. But he's lost his gun. He only has a knife. Confronting Kimathi alone is a huge risk. Still, the soldier thinks it's his duty, so he steels himself and creeps forward. He pulls himself up the same slope, through tangles of vines and thorns. But when he reaches the top, Kimathi is waiting for him, and he's holding a pistol. The young soldier throws himself backward as a shot rings out. He tumbles down the hillside until he lands hard in a heap of dirt and leaves. Stunned, he lies still for a moment, staring at the trees above him, bracing for pain, but it never comes. He looks down. He can't see any blood. The bullet has only grazed his jacket. It's a miracle. So catching his breath, the soldier hauls himself to his feet, but the forest around him is now silent. Dedan Kimathi is gone. Over the next few hours, the soldier's detachment regroups and sweeps the area, rounding up the remaining rebels, capturing everyone except Dedan Kimathi. But the net is tightening. Alone in the forest, Kimathi won't be able to stay hidden for long, and it will only be a matter of time before he's captured, tried, and executed on February 18, 1957. I'm still putting the finishing touches on my live show. I've got about 10 days left before we begin rehearsals, and it's kind of stressful. But the reason is, I'm packing the show with all sorts of entertainment. There's history, of course, but also drama, music, maps, even time series population charts, and I know you love a good data visualization. Speaking of visualizations, imagine this. The perfect seat, dead center in the theater, not too close and not too far from stage. Well, that one's been sold already. Tickets are going fast for the Dallas show, so buy yours today. And to be the first to know when we announce new dates, go to historydailylive.com to register for details. That's historydailylive.com. History Daily is sponsored by Quince. The difference between stuffing a closet and building a wardrobe is all about pieces that work together and hold up over time. That's what Quince does best. Premium materials, thoughtful design, and everyday staples that feel easy to wear and easy to rely on, even as the weather shifts. And boy, can the weather shift. Here in Dallas, we went from 50 to zero in just 2 days. So layers are important. Organic cotton sweaters, polos for every occasion, lighter jackets, and thicker coats. Quince has them all, working directly with top factories and cutting out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup, just quality clothing. Like the pieces we outfitted our daughter with, a new hoodie, some wide leg fleece pants, and even a bracelet that she's yet to take off. So refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/historydaily. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/historydaily. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is February 18th, 1957, the execution of Dedan Kamathi. It's dusk on March 6, 1955, in the Aberdare Mountains of Kenya, more than a year before the British crushed the Mau Mau Rebellion. 34-year-old Dedan Kamathi enters a long bamboo hall, wearing a traditional sheepskin cloak and feather beret. Flanked by armed guards, he strides toward a raised platform at the far end of the hall, where a tall and stern-faced man waits, holding a ceremonial horn. For generations, the Kikuyu people have gathered in mountain halls like this one to select their leaders. Even while Kenya has been governed by officials appointed in Britain, they have preserved their traditions. But today's ceremony is not about looking to the past. Kamathi is here to be named the prime minister of a new rebel parliament, one with the explicit goal of gaining independence. Reaching the front of the hall, Kamathi bows. The man on the platform raises the ceremonial horn and pours mead and sheep fat over Kamathi's head. According to ancient tradition, this slippery liquid will protect and strengthen Kamathi against his enemies. As the mixture drips onto the floor, the man turns to the others assembled in the hall and recounts Kamathi's tireless struggle for independence. Born in the Central Highlands, as a young man, Kamathi struggled to find purpose in life. He was smart and a persuasive speaker, but he drifted through a series of jobs, including a brief stint in the colonial army, before he finally found his calling in the Kenyan trade union movement. He campaigned for better wages and working conditions, but time and time again, the British authorities blocked the union's demands for reform. Eventually, Kamathi came to the conclusion that real change in Kenya would take more than powerful speeches or even widespread strikes. Real change would only be affected by violence. So in 1951, at the age of 30, Kamathi joined the Mau Mau, a guerrilla group fighting to end British colonial rule. His discipline, intelligence, and dedication saw him quickly rise through the ranks, and by 1953, he was effectively the movement's leader. At Kamathi's urging, Mau Mau fighters escalated their campaign. But after they assassinated a senior chief who was loyal to the British, London responded by declaring a state of emergency in Kenya. A bounty was put on Kamathi's head, and he fled into the Aberdare Mountains. But he's not given up the fight. Now, with his appointment as prime minister of the newly created rebel parliament, Kamathi swears to uphold his people's freedom and reclaim their stolen land. But the ceremony is marred by a notable absence. Another leader from the Mau Mau movement has not come. 35-year-old Stanley Mathenge arrives long after this ceremony has ended. Even then, he offers only a cold, begrudging acceptance of Kamathi's new role. He doesn't trust Kamathi. In his view, Kamathi is too easily influenced by a small circle of advisors and too willing to sideline the ordinary soldiers who form the backbone of the uprising. But despite this simmering rivalry, over the next few weeks, Kamathi forges the loosely organized rebels into disciplined soldiers. But the colonial government doesn't stand by and just wait to be attacked. Its forces flood into the valleys of the Central Highlands, sweeping through Kikuyu villages. Tens of thousands of people are rounded up and detained, often with no evidence that they are part of the Mau Mau movement. Hundreds are executed. Thousands more die of disease and starvation. This brutality causes one prominent rebel to think again about the uprising. Stanley Mathenge opens negotiations with the British. Kamathi is furious at what he sees as a betrayal and denounces Mathenge. The rivalry between these two leaders now threatens to tear the Mau Mau movement apart. And as the rebels are forced to choose sides, the uprising disintegrates. Mathenge goes missing, having either fled the country to save himself or been killed by Kamathi's allies. Whatever his fate, the British are quick to take advantage. They offer amnesty to Mathenge's remaining men, but only if they turn on their former comrades and help capture Kamathi. As his enemies close in on all sides, Kamathi and a dwindling band of supporters are forced deeper and deeper into the mountains. In October 1956, a raid on their hideout scatters the last of Kamathi's group. He escapes by chance, narrowly avoiding capture when a single soldier chases him through the forest. But now he's completely alone, and he won't be able to evade capture for long. And soon, Dedan Kamathi will fall into the hands of the British, and the colonial authorities will show no mercy. History Daily is sponsored by Quince. The difference between stuffing a closet and building a wardrobe is all about pieces that work together and hold up over time. That's what Quince does best. Premium materials, thoughtful design, and everyday staples that feel easy to wear and easy to rely on, even as the weather shifts. And boy, can the weather shift. Here in Dallas, we went from 50 to 0 in just 2 days. So layers are important. Organic cotton sweaters, polos for every occasion, lighter jackets, and thicker coats. Quince has them all, working directly with top factories and cutting out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup, just quality clothing, like the pieces we outfitted our daughter with, a new hoodie, some wide leg fleece pants, and even a bracelet that she's yet to take off. So refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/historydaily. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/historydaily. It's early morning on October 21st, 1956, in the Aberdare Mountains of Kenya, 4 days after Dedan Kimathi escaped a raid on his hideout. Police officer Undurangu Mao flicks away a cigarette and tells his men that their break is over. With a low chorus of grumbles, the other officers get to their feet, pick up their weapons, and follow Undurangu up the narrow trail leading higher into the mountains. Through the freezing mist, they scan the forest around them for any movement. Rebel leader Dedan Kimathi hasn't been seen for days, so the British have called in the local police to help with the search. After a little while, the path opens up, and Undurangu orders his men to fan out. After hearing reports of stolen food in the area, he suspects Kimathi must be close. At this altitude, the air is thin and bitterly cold. Undurangu's breath hangs in pale clouds, mingling with the thick fog all around him. It's through this mist that suddenly Undurangu catches a flicker of movement to his right. Creeping forward, he reaches the edge of a ravine. He peers over, and a man in a leopard skin jacket is picking his way through the undergrowth. Undurangu raises his rifle and shouts for him to stop. The long-haired figure freezes, and slowly he lifts his hands as if in surrender. But then he bolts, sprinting toward the cover of nearby trees. Undurangu fires 3 quick shots. His target staggers, falling into the undergrowth. The man then tries to get up, but his leg gives way. He can only crawl just far enough to slip into the trees and out of sight. Officer Undurangu blows his whistle, summoning his men. He orders 2 of them to stay at the top of the ravine and keep watch in case the runaway tries to escape. Then he and his other men scramble down the rock face, and when they reach the bottom, they see a trail of blood leading into the trees. Undurangu follows it, moving slowly, watching for any sudden movement. The fugitive can't have gone far with a bullet in his leg, and sure enough, it's not long before he catches sight of the wounded man grimacing in pain among the undergrowth. Undurangu calls out, telling him to surrender. The man lifts his hands again, but Officer Undurangu takes no chances. Shouldering their rifles, the policemen close in, circling the fugitive. Standing over the fallen man, Undurangu levels his weapon and asks for a name. Through clenched teeth, the man confirms that he is Dedan Kimathi. Undurangu and his men then drag Kimathi down the mountain. He's rushed to a hospital to have his wound treated. But once it's clear that his life isn't in danger, he's moved to a cold, concrete prison cell. By now, Kimathi has gained near-mythical status among some Kenyans. They say he possesses supernatural powers, that he can turn into a leopard or has become immortal. Whatever they might believe, his supporters surround the prison, praying for a miracle. But the colonial police keep a tight perimeter. Whether Kimathi has special powers or not, they are not taking any chances. Kimathi is then put on trial in November 1956. But the British authorities don't want him using the occasion to promote his cause. So they ignore his role in the Mau Mau Rebellion and instead try Kimathi on lesser charges of illegally possessing firearms and ammunition. In court, Kimathi is only permitted to address the specific charges against him, and whenever he tries to talk about Kenyan independence, he's silenced. Still, he maintains his innocence, claiming that he was traveling with the weapons to the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to surrender them to authorities. But the judge rejects this story, pointing to his flight through the forest as proof of guilt. And after a trial lasting just 1 day, Kimathi is sentenced to death. On the eve of his execution, Komathi is allowed one last visitor, his wife, Mukami. Thanks to the uprising, they haven't seen each other for years, and as they embrace, Komathi tells her not to cry. He's accepted his fate, and he explains that his blood will water the tree of Kenyan independence. But on this, the final night of his life, Komathi doesn't sleep. He stares at the ceiling of his cell, pondering his legacy. To the British, he's just a criminal, but he's certain in his own mind that his cause is just, and that one day his nation will be free, and he's right. Kenya will win its independence, but Dedan Komathi's contribution to that victory will long be debated, and it will be decades before his struggle and sacrifice will be properly remembered. History Daily is sponsored by Quince. The difference between stuffing a closet and building a wardrobe is all about pieces that work together and hold up over time. That's what Quince does best. Premium materials, thoughtful design, and everyday staples that feel easy to wear and easy to rely on, even as the weather shifts. And boy, can the weather shift. Here in Dallas, we went from 50 to zero in just 2 days. So layers are important. Organic cotton sweaters, polos for every occasion, lighter jackets, and thicker coats. Quince has them all, working directly with top factories and cutting out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup, just quality clothing. Like the pieces we outfitted our daughter with, a new hoodie, some wide leg fleece pants, and even a bracelet that she's yet to take off. So refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/historydaily for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/historydaily. Free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/historydaily. It's 6 a.m. on February 18, 1957, at Kamiti Prison in Nairobi, only 4 months after Dedan Komathi was captured. A guard unlocks a heavy cell door and tells the prisoner inside that it's time. Silently, 36-year-old Komathi rises. He follows the guard down a long gray hallway where a door swings open and they step outside into the pale haze of dawn. In the courtyard there, Komathi stops, listening to the birds one final time. The guard allows him this moment, then gently nudges him forward. They round the corner and approach a small box-like structure, shrouded in tarps that disguise the gallows inside. The guard then hands Komathi over to the executioner and steps away. This man takes Komathi with him into the execution chamber, and a few moments later, the guard hears a muffled crack and then silence. Following his hanging, Komathi is buried in an unmarked grave in the prison grounds, alongside hundreds of others executed for their part in the Mau Mau Rebellion. But just as Komathi hoped, his blood does water the Tree of Independence. British politicians realize that the only way they can hold Kenya is through force, and it's a cost that they are increasingly unwilling to bear. Instead, they begin to concede to Kenyan demands for change. They introduce constitutional reforms that set Kenya on a path to independence, which is finally achieved in 1963. But in the years that follow, the new Kenyan government is hesitant to confront the legacy of the Mau Mau Rebellion. The first president of the independent Kenya downplays the role of that uprising and the leadership of Dedan Komathi. He urges his people to look forward, not back. But attitudes begin to change in 1990 when the iconic South African leader Nelson Mandela visits Kenya and asks to see Komathi's grave. His request is almost impossible to fulfill. No one knows exactly where Komathi is buried. But Mandela's interest prompts a re-examination of the past, and Komathi's reputation in Kenya is gradually rehabilitated. Today, a bronze statue of Komathi towers above the traffic in downtown Nairobi. Though this monument can't tell the entire complex story of his fight against the colonial authorities, there, in the heart of the Kenyan capital, there is now a constant reminder of his contribution to the country's independence, a cause Dedan Komathi died for on February 18, 1957. Next on History Daily, February 19, 1963. The traditional role of American women as housewives and mothers is challenged by the publication of a groundbreaking book, The Feminine Mystique. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily. hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazib. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Thrum. This episode is written and researched by Angus Gavin McCarron. Edited by Scott Reeves. Managing producer Emily Burke. Executive producers are William Simpson for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.